wanted to move into looking at where we're going. You know, we've kind of set the bar of or the stage of where we've been and where we are. And I'd like to try and look a little bit at where we're going and then ultimately talk about what we think as a group some next steps might be. We recognize the problems that exist. And by the way, at some level, this room in which you're meeting kind of epitomizes both the challenges and opportunities of the digital future of the state. This is, as you can see, built as a TV studio. We have two other TV studios over across the street. And what we ultimately want this to be is the digital heart of the college, a completely multimedia digital lab that is operating on every platform, that is used by the technology industry in broad strokes, by the media industry, as a beta testing site, a place where students can play with concepts, play with technologies, produce content in partnership with news organizations. So this is my challenge of getting this furnished, and that's where we are. We also have a huge new influx of students. I'm sure most of you know, and certainly Representative McCoy knows, the university took in an additional 1,000 students, 1,200 students in the freshman class this year. So we went from a 3,000 student freshman class to a 4,200 student freshman class. And the implications for the university in terms of facilities and faculty, et cetera, are huge. We, just in context, we as the Communication College, this year I have 1,800 more butts in seats in classes than we had last year. I mean, it's just a staggering number. We'll be increasing our major by a third, the number of students enrolled in our major by a third over the next 2 years. And so for us, it's both a good thing, it's an opportunity in that the university has also changed the funding model. Up until now, to overgeneralize, how we got money was pretty arbitrary, which dean could lobby better, et cetera. But now we're switching to an enrollment-based model where I will get, you know, a buck for every butt in a seat. And so that allows us to plan, because we are a destination major. We're turning kids away at the door. And so we're expanding. We just hired 5 new faculty, et cetera. But we need a lot more facilities in my, you know, what I get out of additional butts and seats doesn't provide the facilities. So we're just a little ad. We're in the process of looking for ways to, in partnership with others in the state, turn this into a digital beta lab that serves the state, that serves the state's interest, that serves the industries, the broad industries that we partner with. So, add over. But speaking of technology, I'd like to turn to the tech guys a little bit and talk about where, in terms, and I'll start with Steve, and you all know Steve is with the Washington Technology Industry Association and formerly Microsoft. Where is the technology going? We've talked about the fact that, you know, no matter how big you make the pipeline, you know, somebody's going to make a bigger app, and it's a never-ending process. But in terms of this state, where is the technology going? What are there solutions coming from the tech industry that would begin to address some of the challenges we talk about?
Pretty broad question.
I know.
Some of the folks who represent some of the broadband providers here are probably better in a better position to address the specific issues around broadband. But, you know, it's clear, you know, as Tom made the point earlier, that both the demand for broadband as well as generally the capacity available is roughly doubling about every, you know, 9, 10, 12 months or something like that. The providers...
That Novotny principle.
Yeah. actually, Bob Metcalf, who, you know, was one of the original internet gurus, sort of took credit for that. But And that's continuing. It's clear that it will continue. It's also clear, as we've had several discussions this morning, that it's going to be somewhat spotty because it's going to be more difficult for various reasons to get high bandwidth connectivity in some areas than others. Some of it's just purely capitalistic reasons. Some of it is other kinds of reasons. Some of it's technology reasons. But the technology reasons, actually, I think, are largely there's no magic there. I think there are clear solutions technically to being able to provide bandwidth. So the interesting part, and one of the reasons I kept asking questions about, you know, some of the media aspects of this and business model aspects this morning, was because I think that's where the much more interesting challenges are. So the technology is available. It's certainly possible, as demonstrated in some places, that you can run fiber to homes in even small communities. And it works. You have to solve the backhaul problems. It's hard to get people to agree to even put, in some cases, cabinets, not even towers, in neighborhoods. So you have siting problems of various kinds. Those are going to continue. And then you have the socioeconomic issues related to, people being able to, you have the possibility to get high bandwidth to your home or your residence, but even at $9.95 a month, you may not be able to afford it. And clearly we have to continue trying to find ways to address those. The other really interesting things that are going to continue at a probably even rapidly increasing pace, if you can believe it, on the technology side, are simply the kinds of end-user connectivity that's available. So, all of us in this room, sort of qualify as a relatively elite class. We're all carrying smartphones. A whole bunch of us are carrying, iPads or laptops or Macs or something. We're all sitting here answering email, during pauses in the conversation.
Not during pauses in the conversation.
Multitasking, if you will. Even though psychologists approve it, we can't multitask. The bandwidth that's available to us here in this room, even though we've got 30 or 40 of us using it at any given time, obviously is pretty good.
I hear some complaints from the back corner, but
okay. That's because somebody has a jammer right behind that.
It must be Sprint customers.
That was very good of you to select the one carrier.
It's not here. Exactly. That's actually a tech rule.
The end devices, the progress in the end devices is just amazing. Even if you just look at sort of incremental changes, this new iPad relative to the old iPad, it's incredible. The kinds of performance we're getting out of smartphones right now, the kinds of displays, the kind of bandwidth, the 4G coverage. There are a lot of places, probably if I walked out to the front room there where I actually have 4G connectivity on my phone, I would bet that I'd get higher bandwidth out of the wireless 4G connection on my phone than I do from their Wi-Fi. The technology, I think in many ways, is going to continue to be way ahead of the political issues, the social issues, the socioeconomic issues that we have to deal with. And so I'm actually much more interested in focusing on that. And one of our big platform areas for the technology industry is, of course, education. Representative McCoy brought it up a couple times, big need for STEM degrees. And there's a huge need to do a much better job starting that education in the K through 12. Because we don't do a better job of that, then we don't have the people to feed the university and college systems around the state. And we're way, way behind in terms of our ability to turn out qualified technology graduates in this state. And in spite of that, you have companies like Google, Facebook, Zynga, you know, go down the list, I'm probably missing a half a dozen of them, that have recently started locating engineering centers in the Pacific Northwest, specifically because they think it's attractive to attract people here. And then on top of that, you've got Microsoft with thousands of job openings and Amazon with thousands of job openings and so on and so forth. And we're having to struggle to import people to fill those openings. So, that's a whole bunch of different topics, but it's sort of the landscape I see.
Representative McCoy, I mean, on this issue of importing labor, is there, we talked about the lack of understanding of the technology at some level among some legislators. Is there an awareness of the need to create a digitally literate workforce, or is there a satisfaction that we can import these people?
No, we need to grow them at home. In my opinion, there's enough capacity to turn out the engineers that we need in the university systems. But we also need more technicians that have come the CTE route, because you still need those individuals, as I say in my other speeches, someone that can turn the wrench or the screwdriver, that it's going to do the manual labor, you know, because these cables don't string themselves. And you don't need a college education to string the cable. You don't need a college education to put the cables together. Even now, splicing fiber is down to basically just super glue and stick it together. That's oversimplification,
sure,
folks. But anyway.
Said Representative.
But I'm just trying to get a point here is that, you know, we don't need the entire field 4-year educated. 2-year, yes. Some high school, yes. So we need that blend. And so consequently, that's why we need to grow them at home. I'm really, and I mentioned this before, I was really excited about Microsoft and the OSPI signing that agreement, getting those certification programs into the high schools, and they just graduated their first cohort. So that's great. Now those kids, if they're out in rural areas, they got something that they can stay home for now. But, you know, we got to get the technology out there so that they can be the next ISP person. And so that's why it's very important to get it out there and that we can get economic development going all over the state, not just in certain areas like the Tri-Cities, Spokane, and then the Puget Sound region. You know, we need to spread it throughout the state. Now, granted, you know, these big data centers, they don't employ a lot of people. You know, someplace around 30 people is all that's required. But yet, then again, there's technologies coming through the pipeline now that's going to reduce the size of those data centers. And they won't need all the air conditioning that they need. So technology is moving fast, and we got to keep up with it.
Dan, if I can come to you, what, as your company and the other companies look at the state and look at the development of the state, I mean, what's in the pipeline from you? How What's the architecture of where you're going?
Well, it's probably similar for this state. I mean, we're all national companies, so it's really,
sure,
you know, not so much specific to the state of Washington. But I think for our industry, you know, the network is the king. I mean, that's what we're basically, a network provider. We sell devices, we sell the applications that go on those devices. And there's a lot of cool stuff happening there, especially with pads and things like that. But for us, the primary focus is always going to be on the network. So all of us are, you know, competing very much to provide the best coverage, the best capacity that we can. Because, again, that we're in a very competitive industry, and we know that's our lifeblood is the network. And there's some really exciting things happening there, especially with LTE rollout on the wireless side.
Explain that for those of us.
So LTE stands for long-term evolution, and that's the next really big leap in wireless data speed. And it does, along with providing faster speeds, it does some other things in terms of allowing us to use radio spectrum more efficiently. And so there's some kind of inside baseball, so to speak, benefits that come with that. But that's really, and you're starting to see that now in our advertising, and that's what that terminology stands for. And so everybody, all the wireless carriers are moving as fast as they can to that platform. And it's the devices that will go with it will be really cool. They'll be much faster. It'll allow much more sophisticated applications. And so I think that's really the direction right now we're headed, including in the state of Washington.
Dean, if I could just...
Yeah, please.
And Dan's right. LTE is a standard. So you hear 4G, and we have 4G. Really, it's long-term evolution, which is a standard. You know, it's a modulation standard. And I'm not, you know, an engineer could describe it to you, but it's really...
And beyond, I still wouldn't understand.
Right, beyond 4G. So LTE is what you should really listen for in terms of whether a company is at the next standard. And as Dan said, we're all moving toward that. For example, in Washington, I was pulling up an email as you were talking. I'll admit that, because it was a press release that we issued. Scott Charlson is here, issued just a few days ago, that talked about Verizon's LTE infrastructure now in eastern Washington as well. In addition to Spokane Valley, moved into now Cheney and Deer Park, and we're down the I-5 corridor. We have, you know, the most LTE rollout, the biggest rollout so far, you know, to date. And part of that is because we were successful bidders in a spectrum, 700 megahertz C-band spectrum a couple of years ago. It's very important. It's contiguous, the spectrum, in the United States and Hawaii. And we purchased some additional in Alaska, so we'll be all over. Now, in terms of the rural side of this, what Verizon is doing is partnering, announced this recently, a partnership with rural wireless providers to lease our spectrum. It's not cost-effective for us to build towers and backhaul infrastructure, so lease our spectrum to rural providers who can in turn provide to their customers at those LTE speeds, which, by the way, at this point are 10 times faster than 3G. And we'll move next to advanced LTE, which is, you know, another quantum leap as well. So that's sort of where, you know, where we're racing to get to. And I think somebody said, maybe it was Steve, you know, once you, from our viewpoint, you build this network, that then calls for the building of better devices, which calls for, you know, apps, stronger apps, and it's a virtuous cycle. So led by, I think, building out the network, which we're all doing.
What does, yeah, please.
Just to try to put some numbers to this, I ran some very rough numbers, probably over beers with these guys one night, that looked at how much money was going into the state in terms of broadband build out over the next, say, 3 or 4 years. And I don't think I really have AT&T's and Verizon Wireless's numbers captured in these, but when you look at CenturyLink, Frontier, all of our small companies in the state, Comcast, and a couple of others, it's over $500 million of broadband build-out in the next 3 to 4 years.
And you've got the federal money on top of that.
And I actually rolled No One Ed into that as well. So it's
and
a chunk
of change. I can give you a number for AT&T, just not future look, but from 2009, 2011, we invested $1.5 billion in our network in the state of Washington. So, and most of that is upgrading the current network to get to those LTE speeds. So, sorry, Ben.
Yeah.
I have a question for the tech people on the panel.
When the FCC mandated that broadcast TV go digital to free up that spectrum that was going to go to the wireless, what's the status of that? Is that spectrum being used for these new LTE?
700 megahertz that I was speaking of, is that freed up spectrum?
Okay.
Yeah, some of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's different. To answer your question, that's different from the LTE transition, which is a technological transition, not a spectrum transition.
Right.
Spectrum is one of the things I wanted to talk about because it's really, really important on the wireless side. And that's, when I say spectrum, what you can should think of is just the amount of the radio waves that a company gets to use to provide its service. And that amount is directly proportional to how much capacity you have. So the more spectrum, the more capacity there is. And at some point, there are ways to kind of, there are engineering ways to trick that equation so you can build more towers for a while and gain more capacity. You can add more radios for a while and gain more capacity. But eventually those things start to interfere with each other when you get too many towers and too many radios. So the only way to effectively deal with that is to get more spectrum to increase wireless broadband capacity. When analog television was switched to digital, one of the advantages of that transition was that digital broadcasting was more efficient than analog broadcasting. So it essentially freed up, as Milt said, some of that 700 megahertz spectrum, which is in the wireless industry called beachfront spectrum, that could be used for on the wireless side. And when I say used, that means wireless carriers could win it at an auction, pay the government a lot of money, and make use of it. It's called beachfront spectrum because, all things being equal, that low-band spectrum, which 700 is, goes farther and penetrates buildings better than higher-band spectrum. So all spectrum is not created equal. And I don't know, I don't want to give a spectrum tutorial, but what you have out there in the wireless world right now are several different kinds of spectrum. You have the original cellular spectrum, which was two licenses, and that's kind of in the 850 frequency band. You have the spectrum that was made available in 1996 in an auction, which was called PCS spectrum, Personal Communication Services. That's in the 1900 band, so that's a lot higher frequency spectrum. Doesn't travel as far as the lower band spectrum, doesn't penetrate buildings as well as the lower band spectrum. Then you've got AWS spectrum, which is kind of in the same range as the PCS. It's up there near the top. You've got the spectrum from the digital television transition, which is 700 back down at the bottom. So it's very, very complicated. And one of the things that is confusing for customers, and I'm sure a lot of you have both heard this and maybe thought it yourself, why can't I take my device from one carrier to another? Why can't I just, you know, change from, nobody would want to change away from my company.
Yeah. Of course.
To change from AT&T to T-Mobile to pick on Dan. That actually is a change that can work, but in order for it to work, the devices have to be compatible both in terms of the modulation that the carrier is using and in terms of the frequency bands built into the device. And different carriers have, because they're auctioned off, different frequency bands that they have available to them. So you might have an AT&T iPhone, for example, that uses the same modulation techniques as a T-Mobile phone, but it doesn't use the same band for its high-speed data service. So if you bring that phone to T-Mobile, it will work, but you won't get high-speed data because it doesn't have our bands built into the phone for high-speed data. Lots and lots of nuances that are kind of behind the scenes and deliberately hidden from consumers, because the last thing any of us want is for consumers to have to worry about what band they're on and what the modulation technique is. But it's very important in terms of setting and making some of these policy decisions. Great. Sorry, I'm sure that was more than anybody wanted to know about spectrum.
But no, very interesting.
Well, the one other issue is we're running out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the, probably the biggest policy issue facing the wireless industry right now is the impending spectrum crunch is what we're calling it, because it is a scarce and limited commodity. And at some point, because of the huge amount of capacity that we're using on all the new kinds of cool devices we have, we are flat out going to run out of spectrum. And that has all kinds of implications for consumers in terms of how you price what your service, and whether your device is going to be able to work the way you want it to work. And it's a huge question that's in front of the Congress right now and how they're going to make additional spectrum available. And so that's, I know our company, that's our main focus right now in the nation's capital, is how we can address this issue.
And what are the options for getting more spectrum?
Well, the federal government has quite a bit of it being used for other purposes. But, of course, those uses, and they could be military uses or others, those folks don't want to give it up either because they know, again, it's a scarce commodity. So we have to figure out, are there ways of sharing it, sharing uses? Are there services that the federal government now uses those for? Can those be eliminated or changed? There's a lot of work being done right now to kind of figure out how to answer that question.
And interestingly enough, because it touches on the media part of the world, the FCC just received from Congress the ability to hold incentive auctions,
right?
Which means that broadcasters will be able, if they want, to kind of turn back some of their spectrum to be auctioned off and receive a share of the proceeds from the auction. So that's never been possible under the law before that. If it happens, it will be a very complicated process because not only do broadcasters need to figure out if there is any spectrum there to turn back, but it has to be then repacked by the FCC and rebanded to make it usable for mobile services. But that's a tool out there that's never existed before.
So if we move forward, we're working on the assumption that there will be more and faster access as we go down the road. What does that mean for the rest of us? What does that mean, for example, Christy, in your world, or Don, in your world? Don's also with the Whitman County Libraries, in terms of serving your customers, your communities?
Well, we are a small, we service a rural populace. We have 14 branches all around the county. So for us, it would mean being able to offer some of the programs which we may only have at one branch to all of those branches, be able to branch out in that fashion. Also, I think one of the early slides where they showed speed versus number of users, well, currently we may have 3 megabits per second in one of our branches. When we get 5 staff members and a dozen patrons using computers, that hits rock bottom. So it would increase what we can offer our patrons. It would also tend to make our system more reliable, is one of the other things we're looking at, is reliability and making that easier for people to access the information they want. So.
And I would only add, we've been exploring other ways the library can help our communities, and that might be having computer labs often more. That might be having other agencies come in and use the broadband that we have available. I mean, we'd love to explore educational purposes. I think distance education eventually would be a great thing to offer. Really, the possibilities are so endless. I just think they're going to develop as soon as the technology is there.
Monica,
your question. From the community standpoint and the journalism standpoint, increased access and faster service could mean some really helpful things that dovetail with open data and just a better public information architecture. And there's this sort of bifurcation that's starting to devolve, I think, between news and information. We know that there are distinct definitions, but lots of times what people want is information more than news. So, for instance, with better access and better speed, we could, number one, capitalize on data sets that governments are increasingly putting online. And developers come along and develop what are called civic apps based on data sets. And in a way, that's sort of a flavor of the month or flavor of the decade thing. Governments look open because they put 400 data sets online, but then who comes along and does anything with it? But actually, people are starting to do things with it. And some of this is mobile, so that relates to how good your mobile service is. There's an app that's used in King County, built off government data that you can replicate around the state in more rural areas. It's called Dangerous, and it's based on Seattle, King County Health Department restaurant inspection data. It's all, that stuff, all that stuff you really don't want to read, but you know maybe you should before you go in. And so you can just dial it up on a map and get the latest results. What were the violations? Did they exceed the threshold level for? So there's an example, but there's other stuff too that the state government could be doing and they're not yet. It could take the form of data sets or just things that people would want to access, like the state health department issues press releases with license numbers of health care professionals who had their licenses suspended for unprofessional conduct, you know, nurses or assistants who've been taking the morphine that was meant for their patients, or therapists who've entered into inappropriate relationships with it. That's all great, and you can go to a database and get the disciplinary documents, but you can't search the database by facility, right? So suppose you had an elderly parent who was moving to your state and you needed to find them a facility to live in. There may have been many violations at a particular facility by individual providers, but you would never know that. So there are conversations that need to occur with the government information providers, and then eventually better data systems built for people to use. And that's really information more than news, but then again, it stuff might be put out there in a CSV file format for developers to build an app around that too. You know, enter the name of the facility that you're considering putting your parent in, and you'll immediately get returned to you all the disciplinary documents involving people who worked there over the last 10 years. That would be amazing. So that kind of stuff, and there are many other examples. There's OSPI in their database on teachers who've had their licenses revoked or suspended for, you know, usually inappropriate relationships with students. But right now, all you can do is go to a web page, and it's arranged alphabetically by teacher.
Oh.
You can't search it by school district, and you can't search it in reverse state order. So those are some of the conversations that our nonprofit continues to have with government information providers and with civic apps developers. And all this stuff is going to get better and more refined over time, and I think it can dovetail with some of the technological improvements that we're talking about here. And none of us would say that folks in, quote, rural areas, knowing that rural has many definitions, aren't interested in this stuff. They're as interested in this stuff as people on the west side. So by stressing the benefits of this, you know, what do you get once you have the improved technology, that can maybe help goose the pressure a little bit for improving the technology in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And I think the increased speeds are going to, in addition to greatly increasing our educational, they're also going to increase civic involvement. When the library hosts a voter forum, which we have, it gives people in our other branches the opportunity to participate in that forum as well, without having to drive the wonderful loose weather. So I think that education involvement and journalism, from where we're talking about the local journalism, where someone would investigate these things are online. You can give access to those sorts of.
Ben?
Yeah, and we had a chance to talk about this earlier, and I think Steve makes a really good point that the technology is outpacing even almost the public records law right now, that these municipalities are required to release this information. They're not necessarily required to release it in an easily digestible form or accessible form. So you go to King County and you'll see records that are readily available. You go to rural reaches of the state and those documents won't be available unless you're willing to go in and make copies on a photo machine.
Monica, rather. Sorry.
Hi. I'm working with Washington State University Extension, and the work that I do has been out in rural communities, and I found some really interesting things happening when we went out and we started looking at rural communities and started looking at those where broadband had been deployed. We were finding people making these incredible quality of life choices to live in the community they wanted to live in because they could. They could now bring their skills and be a teleworker. They could bring their entrepreneurial interests and start a business. They could expand a business. We helped Washington Dental Service locate their customer service and data processing center in Colville because there was broadband there. And so the economic impacts and opportunities are incredible when there's broadband. But we also have found in many of these rural communities that even when broadband is there, people are not taking advantage of it. And they're not taking advantage of it because we still have a huge education piece that needs to happen. And it's both the awareness building, the relevance, so people understand what it is, and also the skills and training to be able to use it. So I don't want that to get lost as we talk about this access piece, because yes, it's getting faster and better and more available. And those that know that are taking advantage of it, but we still have a huge group that don't know how best to engage.
So whose responsibility is it to do that?
I think the media plays a big role, or can in this case. I mean, Pew, when you look at non-adopters, I think the Pew Research says it's not cost, it's relevance. People do not see broadband is relevant to their lives, which
not yet
floored me. But
and sometimes when it's cost, it's not only about the access to the infrastructure, the network that we've been talking about, but it's having places like libraries be available where the technology is also available. Mm-hmm. And Christy and I were talking, and I've had several conversations with the state library system. There's some amazing ways that libraries can be a part of the solution. I think one of the things I'm finding is that sometimes the smaller the community, the more partners we need, mm-hmm. and the more pieces we need to have happen at one location. So it may be a library that's an anchor tenant, but then social services are provided there, and they help foot the bill for the technology and the space and all. It may be education that helps pay the bill. You need many partners. I don't know that it falls on any one entity. We're all in this together.
Without a curator, information is, you know, almost impossible to decipher for most people. And so, again, I think, you know, where the media is involved, we need to continue to develop the ability to hire journalists, curators, you know, to help make sense of some of that. And I think, you know, that's one part of the conversation. That access is one thing, but what can we do with it, you know, is the next thing.
I mean, there's really two pieces here, isn't there? There's how do you educate the public who are not digital web savvy? And then how do you leverage these new opportunities? How does the news media and information providers leverage these opportunities? So let me start with that one. And what does you said partnership, you said it's the media's responsibility. What does a partnership look like that?
Well, Frida talked about it this morning, the local technology teams that are going to be funded through the federal grant program. That's really what their purpose is, or one of their prime purposes, is bring local communities together. And this model's been used in a lot of other states. And bring leaders together in education and business and healthcare and you know, all the different segments, and talk about what that local community's broadband needs are. And a big part of that needs to be adoption. How do we educate the community about what technology can do for you, and then again, you know, facilitate that and bring those people together and have those folks then starting to use this technology. So that program is designed exactly to do this.
And we've been doing some of that in the state already. We've got a great example. Frida is very, very much aware of this, because she's gone down with me to Klickitat and Skamania, where we have been doing that. And we started with access issues there because we had a community that had none. But that group is continuing to meet, and they're starting to tackle now the awareness issues, and they're looking at the adoption issues. And it's bringing together everyone at the local in the local area that is a stakeholder, and helping them be a part of it.
And let me clarify, not the media alone. I'm just saying the media can help us reach those non-adopters, because I certainly can't send them an email. But we do see this as a community-wide effort, and there's some interesting work being done in the School of Information at that other state college about digitally inclusive communities and moving not from just having access and I can send an email to my grandson, but meaningful use, which is the next hurdle, I think, for a lot of... Are we using it really for economic development? Are we using it for distance learning? Are we using it in a more meaningful way?
Let me give you an example of what the media could do. I don't know how many stories there have or have not been on this, but there's this fabulous program going on in CenturyLink's territory that offers lower-rate broadband and adoption services and allows people to spend $150 on a netbook. Well, you can't buy a netbook for $150, as we all know. So I think it's also about educating people about what's available, and that's one great example. We were just, Monica and I and Frida were just up in Coopville at one community meeting, and they thought the subject was really about access. And by the end of the meeting, what they recognized was, maybe this is about adoption. And it was amazing what they didn't know about the adoption services that are available just in their communities. Whidbey Telecom has 100% coverage of broadband in their area, and they're offering classes at their center that also happens to be a cafe that makes great coffee. You can go and learn about how to get online, and they have some very basic classes. Well, most people didn't know that. So there's something. I mean, I know it's a boring story. If I could kill somebody during one of the programs, maybe we could get into the newspapers. But
only if it's within the footprint of the
story. It would be both rookie and criminal.
It isn't always a boring story. I'm Carrie Zimmer with CenturyLink, and I actually do the internet basics training. It's one of my many tasks, but it's really exciting when there's an older generational person there that didn't even know what a mouse was, didn't know that the mouse actually interfaced with the screen. And I know that sounds crazy to us, but to see the lights go on in their eyes and then they can, you know, come back to you and tell you that they did connect with their grandchild.
Right.
So, yeah, it seems a little trite to us, but it becomes so empowering to these people. And then the access issue and the relevance of having broadband. Monica and I were up in Colville doing a Stronger Economies Together meeting, and I told a few people that it was all about the fact that there was broadband in this community and how exciting it was. And a gentleman next to me was like, I don't want this here. He said, I moved here because I like this rural lifestyle, and now you're going to bring this internet here, and people are going to move here, and I'm going to have traffic. And he was a cattle rancher, and I said to him, wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to go out and try to sell your cows? You could do it online. And we had a lengthy conversation, and by the end of it, he was a little bit more receptive, but it was an interesting scenario, one that I didn't expect to encounter in a community that had been clamoring for this. So to do education in smaller rural areas, but then larger cities, like the underserved populations that we see in Spokane, in Yakima, where people really do need this information, and not just in English, but Spanish, yeah. Asian, Russian, Hmong. So we're working on all of those elements so that, yes, we bring it to you, but then let's show you how to use it and then make it accessible to you. So there is a $9.95 for at least a minimum of 12 months internet access. They can get a phone line. It is a 1.5 connection. And there is a netbook available for $150. So it's a great program. Comcast has one that's similar. And we've rolled this out throughout our entire footprint. And we're really excited about the responses we're getting. So we haven't done it in Yakima yet. We're on the verge of putting together our first session. But all the libraries are excited to partner with us on it. Many of them already have sessions. They just need somebody to help facilitate, maybe provide materials, maybe provide some funding for the refreshments or the promotion of it all. So I think that's an important element of developing the need and the desire for the access.
There's a statewide organization called Communities Connect, and they're on the online at communitiesconnect.org that is a coalition broadband adoption organizations from around the state, and we're always looking for, you know, new members, and a number of people around this table have sat in on those meetings. We have a what we call a Council on Digital Inclusion, where we, you know, look for some common goals, and it's normally around how do we expand broadband adoption. So just to throw that out there.
So I'd buy that there's a need for us to maybe journalistic, with our journalistic hats on, cover that story more often. But, you know, you're educating folks to buy your product, which is, you know, that's a cool thing. You know?
Well, there's no pressure on that.
It's also called marketing.
It's available to them. But it's not the impetus of the training.
Well, but at the end of the day, if you're the provider in that community, you're profiting from that that training. And that's fine. You know, I don't have an objection to that. It's just worth pointing out. And, you know, I would think that, I would hope that in trying to attract people to that training that will ultimately benefit you, you think about marketing that through media that can, you know, provide service for you. You know, that, you know, we're, and if you want to talk about how people can become civically engaged by using that portal to connect to us, that'd be fine, too.
Absolutely. I think that's what makes the partnership so important. And that's when they get excited about being able to type in so many letters and see something pop up on Google. So I agree with you. Yeah, I think that's a strong partnership.
What's the partnership? I mean, we're...
We'll make the Seattle Times own page.
You'll do that?
We'll advertise the promotion. We'll promote it on your website. We'll show you during the training and then... Well, change revenue. No.
I mean, that is something for media to think about across three points. Number one is, if media, especially local, is demonstrating more tech savvy and awareness of these benefits and then sharing it, frankly, that's going to catch the attention of tech companies who then might be more interested in advertising with that newspaper, sort of a mutual partnership benefit there. But also, like you were talking about the cattlemen, right? Well, Twitter put out this story about Japanese fishermen who go out, and before they have come back and hit the beach, they've tweeted to their loyal audience about all the fresh catch of that day, and by the time they've hit the beach, they've sold the entire boatload. You know, and that is a story that could be shared with, you know, agriculture in terms of selling produce or cattle or whatever it is, but you don't hear about those stories. It's not in the press, at local press, so the local folks don't know about how they could actually leverage the benefits of broadband, you know, through Twitter or something like that. And then, Larry, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to an earlier point with Christy and Don over here. They were talking about the benefits of broadband, and we were talking about spectrum being limited. Well, something more limited than wireless spectrum is time. There is only 24 hours a day. And there are three things that I kept hearing around our state about what broadband does for them, which is, number one, you're more productive. So you have five people who want to go online at the same time. It brings down the broadband speeds. So now they can't all do the work and be done and out. I mean, I hear about teachers who have 150 students that they're managing and trying to process their paperwork, you know, on the computer, and they can't because all the other teachers are doing it at the same time, which makes it for a longer day for them and less quality time they can spend with the students one-on-one. So there's a productivity issue. Secondly, it's the collaboration that it enables you to collaborate from anywhere. So Microsoft's, you know, Representative McCoy was talking about we need to spread tech benefits out throughout the state. Well, you can't do that if you don't have the broadband, but if you have tech-skilled people in other communities, they can work for Microsoft or Amazon or wherever it is that, or another company from another country, because they can all get online and collaborate and be in real-time video conferencing conversations, you know, working on the same document at the same time, but you need the speeds to be able to enable that kind of collaboration. And then the other thing that in City of Seattle, at the workshop there, they were very big on the message of, look, we have affordable access to asymmetrical, faster download, slower upload. What we need is affordable access to symmetrical speed, so it's real time, so that we can collaborate with other
innovative R&D or companies around the world to work on world issues like health, poverty, you know, a lot of those things are out there, and be innovative and collaborative with the best and the smartest minds around in the world. But we can't do that unless we have affordable access to symmetrical in order to get to innovation. So those would be, you know, some of the benefits of broadband that I don't think are being shared with, not just in plain English. It's been too tech, which doesn't sell well in the media, and it's not being brought back to relate to, why does this matter to me? How am I going to benefit from that? But those stories are out there, but they're fragmented. And so something that local media could really do is to maybe put a little bit more attention to those stories, float a few of them out there, and kind of, you know, help build that awareness and education and relevance.
What I see Mike nodding, but I know nodding skeptically. Gary, what's your reaction to that?
Well, a couple of things. I'm glad Mike spoke up, because when this, as this conversation was evolving, I wanted to ask, don't the providers, carriers have an incentive and an obligation to help potential users become more educated and comfortable? So I certainly agree with Mike, and frankly, I wasn't aware of the example of the things that you're doing, which I think is great. You know, in terms of technology, I think newspaper editors learned a long time ago that, and Gannett tried this with a special technology section that they wanted all of their papers to publish once a week. Newspaper editors and their staffs finally realized there's nothing we can do to keep up with the pace of technological change on a regular basis, that people who are really into technology have 1,000 sources, and it's all online. Why do they need the newspaper to, you know, to help them? I mean, they're so far ahead of us. So there's that specialized reader who is never going to go to a newspaper for information, because they know it all, or they know where to get it faster than we can provide it.
I get that. But I also, you know, afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted. As a policy story, the fact that a whole group of people is being left behind in really important ways, whether CenturyLink has a program or not, is a story. I mean, if you can be sitting in Seattle in 2012 and not know how to use a computer, I would argue that's a story these days.
I've seen stories in Seattle media about the Comcast program to provide, you know, basic broadband to low-income families. It's been covered.
Those stories, we got to cover those from a mass audience perspective, not
absolutely
a tech perspective. So I think you're right in that, but
yeah.
But I think we do deserve a bit more credit than the notion that we ignore that. The Seattle Times is a tech town. We have a tech columnist and
tech blog,
and
a tech blog. And tech writer, you know, folks who are assigned full time to the tech industry. So that, you know, the notion that is, you know, an area we don't cover is
oh no, I don't think the point was that you don't
understate
it. Yeah, I don't think the point was that you don't cover it. It was more about, it would be great to hear more coverage about the challenges in the local communities. You know, you obviously cover it in Seattle because we're one of the most tech-savvy, cities. It's the local.
There's something here I want to challenge, which is there's an underlying assumption as part of this line of questioning that says that if you get better media coverage, you will reach those people and cause them who are not connected, who are not aware of these kinds of programs, so on and so forth, and cause them to take some action to get themselves more connected, you know, hook up with these programs. So publicizing the program's great. I mean, it sounds like some of that's being done. But, you know, it seems to me like the only way you're really going to reach a lot of these people is with grassroots. You got to go to the community centers. You got to go to the senior centers. You got to go to the retirement facilities. You know, I can't see that media is actually going to solve much of this problem.
But I would argue it's a combination of all of them. What's that marketing axiom? You have to hear the message 7 times before it comes in. So, I mean,
it has to
come from everywhere. It has to come from your grandkids. It has to come from your senior center. It has to come from your local newspaper.
The answer is yes, but advertising works, and stories work.
Amen, brother.
If, They work. Billions wouldn't be being spent on advertising.
But the other corollary
and stories
to that is
work
that
even better.
The corollary to that is that you are advertising-driven publications, and are you publications that, or news organizations, is this something that you should be taking on as a cause to educate people, or is it something you do a story about occasionally, and those who want to publicize it take ads in your papers or your TV stations or whatever?
Yeah, and where does it fall in the list of causes we ought to take up?
Yeah, you have many.
It's not that it's unworthy, but there are a lot of there's rural health, there's any number of economic issues that are related to a economic divide or a rural urban divide that are important, and this is one of them. And I'm not saying it's low, but you have to consider that in the context of higher education funding and that cause, and to pull up
we
example,
like that.
You might like.
But I can tell you a telehealth application that will make a difference. Remote monitoring on healthcare significantly increases or decreases the amount of emergency room visits. So there's a telehealth application. There's a distance learning application in a rural community. There's a program going on now where they're experimenting with open course. What's the name of it? Anyway, but it's open course books, so that because the single largest expense in the community college system is the books, it's more than tuition. So they're doing that online. That's a broadband connection. I mean, I realize I have a bias, but I can tell you there's a broadband component of every issue you just raised.
I think she's also speaking to the converters.
Well, yeah, and
but I don't think that's not widely known. I don't think that's shared.
Right, and this last session, I was trying to move a bill that addresses what we've been talking about all day. And the only people that covered my piece of legislation was the Wenatchee newspaper and a national tech paper. And that was it. Those are the only ones that covered it. And during the hearings, we talked about a lot of stuff, basically around the same stuff. And my telecom folks were cutting me with paper. WeDo was cutting me with paper. And I couldn't get the bill out. So we're having this conversation now. But during the action in the legislature of trying to get broadband in rural areas, there was no print media, nobody around.
So Larry, to your point about what do we do going forward, it kind of sounded like to me that we've got to make this sexy.
Yeah.
Well, people don't buy things unless they know that they need it. So, I mean, that's part of it. And two, from my media perspective, as long as delivering content through internet and other devices like that is a part of our plan, sure, I want people to have that ability. I mean, look around the room. How many cell phones are here? How many laptops are here? Okay, now how many radios does anybody have?
Right here. I have a radio.
Well, that's exactly right. Okay.
Through the broadband, through the wireless.
So
there's like five of them in my phone.
I just wanted to add, too, for nonprofit media, there is a financial challenge to making the transition to providing everything online. And as people make the switch to accessing it more online, our costs increase. As a broadcaster, for example, for the first 14 years of TVW's existence, our focus was solely on the television signal, and my distribution costs were the same regardless of whether one person is watching that or a million. Not that I think that a million people are watching TVW one time, but
would that they were.
But online, I have to pay. Every time someone streams, I have to pay for the bandwidth to provide that service. So as a nonprofit organization, both making building the technical infrastructure to handle the demand, which is rapidly increasing. We did 2.5 million individual streams of TVW video just in the calendar year of 2011, which is a 400% increase in 2 years. So people are making the change. It's presenting a financial challenge for us to handle that demand and make the technical changes necessary internally to be able to handle it, as also as we move forward in terms of accessing, having the bandwidth accessible to us to be able to handle the demand. So as a nonprofit media, and that may have been, you talked about KUW making the switch. You know, radio sound is a little bit different than TV. We need more for, you know, to stream video, but that may have been some of their reluctance as well as the cost associated for a nonprofit in making that switch.
And let's, you know, let's back up a minute to some of the figures we saw when we first sat down in here this morning. What was it? 77% of the population of the state of Washington has broadband access.
No, actually, it's 90 something.
Has adoption, so that means they're using it somewhere. They may not have a link in
there. The access,
considering
90,
how new the technology is, that's pretty good.
Well, available
to them does not mean they are subscribed.
Okay,
right.
It's a myriad of numbers.
But your point is, it's not a technological issue as much as an education issue, right?
In theory, they can get it. They just need to want it.
And afford it.
Mm-hmm. And if I could chime in, because I agree with so many of the things that have been shared. As a wireless person, I'm with Verizon. We do wireless workshops because we full well know that if you walk out with a smartphone and you only know how to do three things, that's not going to carry you for a couple of months. You're going to turn it back in, and then we've got a big cost to eat. So we have wireless workshops because we know that the number of 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, and 60-year-olds that carry smartphones for the first time is doubling almost every year.
Great.
Big surprise, since that's what we advertise in the Seattle Times every week, is smartphones.
See, advertising works, right, Mike?
You do it every day.
We're trying. So the education piece from all corners is really critical. And I would argue, as a son who first put a Droid X smartphone in my 80-year-old parent's hand about 6 months ago, and every month I'm on the phone, well, here's how you do it. Now, back up a step, touch this thing, touch that thing, move it to the left. That if you can excite them with one thing, then you have a shot at exciting them with another thing. And the one example I would give that's so wonderful about the LTE 4G environment is, let's say I'm at my son's baseball game, if it ever stopped raining enough to have a baseball game. I can use an app to, on my phone call, take a video and feed a live stream by phone to grandma and grandpa who may be 200, 300, 500, 2,000 miles away across the country, and they can watch that baseball game live from the power of my phone over an LTE connection. And they can watch it on their computer or on their phone. So it's that one magic thing, and we all know there's a lot of magic apps that we love to use on our phones or whatever. And if we can excite people in rural communities, I love the telehealth, the telemedicine, that's definitely the future. But there's just so many ways to grab people if we'll show that one demo that we use, how we benefit, how we love it, why, and then share it.